Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, as evidenced by this lovely title behind both of us. My name is David, I'm here with Tim, and we are two guys who take, every week we approach a genre, either horror or science fiction film, novel, television, whatever we're picking up that week, and we try to elevate the key elements in it. What influenced that particular topic, and what did in turn that topic influence? We've been doing it for a while now, and we're so glad you guys are back. We are, I think, midway into our fourth season.
Pretty close. Now.
Yeah, and if you are joining us for the first time, wow, yeah, thank you. You've got
exactly
3.5 years to catch up on. So please go back and listen to us. You can find us on YouTube, Facebook, all those lovely social media places, and our website, johnnyhaskeys.com. And if you are joining us again, you already know all that stuff. So thank you for coming back and doing it. We would also invite both newcomers and oldcomers, if you guys want to become Patreon members with us. We have special things there for our Patreons, including two entirely other podcasts that we have on particular
topics. Little sideshows.
Little sideshows. Like I said, my name is David. I'm here with good friend Tim. Tim, how have you been this lovely week?
Oh, my gosh. I have been absolutely fabulous.
Fabulous.
Not... And I'm not, you know, Patsy or Adina referring. I've just been jonesing, especially that you mentioned it is halfway, and I just realized this is our 20th episode, so we are exactly halfway through the season.
Yes.
And it's a doozy.
But before
I venture that way, what have you been doing? Or would you like me to talk about what I've been doing this week in our little genre?
I have
worlds?
Not done that much. Actually, one thing I did do was I went back and revisited a couple of old sci-fi things for me, because I think I mentioned this a couple of podcasts back, but J. Michael Straczynski is in the early stages of doing a, quote, reboot or reimagining of Babylon 5, one of my favorite series, and I was always I've always been very trepidatious about any continuation, any reboot, anything. But he's the mastermind behind it, so I went back and watched like an episode of season one, an episode of season two, an episode of season three, and went, you know, this really is actually a great series, and I need to jump into it again and rewatch it. And
it's kind of like X-Files.
Yes, and I'm now even more nervous about, oh, should they redo this at all? You know, he's saying, in his mind, think of it much more like Battlestar Galactica, and the fact that, you know, the old one was this, the new one is this. He even mentioned in one of his Instagram posts, he said, or Twitter posts, he said, think of it kind of like The Shining. The book is great. The series, the movie is great. So, you know, it's going to be like that. They're both influenced by the same thing, but they're totally different things. So I'll see what he does.
I don't mean to be the gloom hovering over, but I will say that I was jonesing when the X-Files had a reboot a few years back. And it's not the same. It's just not the same.
No.
Even though it's got the same cast.
Yeah, even with the same cast, writers, director, Chris Carter, all of that, but it just didn't get there. I thought there were a couple each season.
There were a few good ones, but not overall.
But overall, no, it wasn't what it could have been anymore, you know, or was, I think, maybe.
No, I think it would have been better to reboot it with an entirely new cast and characters and just try to, you know, recapture the flavor with, you know, new people. Very similar to what Star Trek does, instead of bringing back the same, you know.
Yeah.
It'd been okay to, it'd been kind of cool to have one of them do a cameo, you know, mid-season two or something. But
And continuing on the whole, oh, this is our son, and this is, I don't think that was a smart move. Yeah. But anyway, so to counteract this week's topic, I kind of had to dive into science fiction world.
I totally get it. And as it has been for a few weeks, so we are so on the same track with our thinking far as reboots and the past, because I finally got around to seeing Halloween Kills.
Oh, did you? Okay. So, yes.
Those of you that heard me talk, I think last season, it may have been earlier this season, I cannot remember, about the original Halloween reboot with Jamie Lee Curtis from 2018. Mm-hmm. I kind of liked it. It had lots of really cute tongue-in-cheek things about it that I found very cool, like similar shots from the first movie, or, you know, instead of him falling out the window and disappearing, her falling out the window and disappearing. Neat little things where they kind of played around with you as far as remembering the original film. Well, this one is totally different. This one was like, we need a middle film because we rebooted a trilogy, John. I have a feeling John and Jamie got together and just said, hey, we need to retire. Let's make a trilogy. And so it's like, what can we squeeze out of the first movie to make people remember that it's still a part of that world? Well, okay, let's bring back Tommy and Lindsay, the kids the original. And sure enough, Real Housewife Kyle Richards reprises her role as Lindsay, the child, the female child that, Nancy Loomis or whoever was babysitting, and then Jamie Lee Curtis ends up with. And Tommy is played by Anthony Michael Hall, you know, John Hughes fame. I mean, it's squeezing a lot. Just squeezing as much as they can to try to relate to that first movie, including a completely CGI'd Sam Loomis. The Donald Pleasance character makes an appearance in this movie. Yes, he's been dead for like 10 years at least, but he's in this movie in a flashback. That picture you see behind me, if you're watching on YouTube, is the CGI version of him in the movie.
So it's, but it's set modern, right? It's set 20, 30, 50 years after the original or whatever.
It is. But in order to bring more characters into the film, they flash back and have scenes where the cops are at the Myers house and something happens. Okay. And one of the main characters is like the cop that could have shot him. And then there's also another character that's the son of the guy that is friends with Tommy and is also dating Jamie Lee Curtis's granddaughter. I mean, there's a lot of shit going on in this movie. And I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, I don't outright hate it, but I mean, it's exactly what I thought it would be.
So, and is it Carpenter? Is Carpenter directing it?
No, but Carpenter and Curtis are producing it, and Carpenter's been doing the music.
So, okay.
I don't know if he did it for this one, but I know he did it for the reboot in 2018. I'm pretty sure he probably did this one as well. Oh, and I left out a huge thing. I was talking about squeezing the sponge to get what they can out of this. Yeah. They also bring back Marion, the nurse that's driving the station wagon when Michael escapes. She's in it too. She's hanging out with Lindsay and Tommy. So I guess even though she's of a different generation, they're friends. They
survived the night he came home. So,
and guess what scene they recreate?
I don't know.
Her in the car up against a passenger window with a hand coming down. It's like, yes, yes. And jumping up on the car and like you hear him up on top of the that yeah, all that shit happens again with the same character.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's worth seeing. It's almost like an amusement park ride. It's like you're going to JC's haunted house to see their version of Halloween or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's just weird. Mm-hmm. And there's also lots of angry mob scenes in this one. It's very Frankenstein, where all of a sudden it's like cops don't work, so the town's going to take care of business. And Anthony Michael Hall's leading them, and instead of a torch, he's got a baseball bat, and they're all after Michael Myers. You know?
All right, then.
And yet there's going to be another one.
And I'm sure it ends in a way that opens up, opens up for the trilogy. Yes.
Yeah, the third one is called Halloween Ends. And I'm like, does it?
It never
ends. Because it seems like it's been going on for about 12 movies now.
Yeah. It never ends. Yeah. The movie nor the holiday.
My week.
So, well, okay. We each got a little bit of a genre taste over here.
And yeah, then we jump into. Sorry about the spoilers, folks, but I mean, you're not really spoiling that much if you haven't seen it already. So.
No. Well, I mean.
You know what's going to happen.
Right. You know, how much could you spoil a remake of a movie from, what, 40 years ago?
Right.
So, but speaking of movies from years and years ago, I guess that's an okay transition to our topic for today, which is in your genre and
Oh, my gosh, it is in my genre, and we flipped
Or is it, I think, is the big question in your genre.
Oh, I think it is. But really? It flipped.
Okay.
I would do my genre week than you, but now I'm doing the movie too, so I'm talking a lot. Here we go. I've been looking forward to this one. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Me too.
I remember liking it a lot. And of course the comparisons to another movie, which is Silence of the Lambs. We are going to cover a movie called Seven.
Mm-hmm.
This is another serial killer movie, and I'm really glad that we're doing it, because really it's the first of this type of movie we have done since we did Silence of the Lambs in the first season. This movie is compared a lot to Silence of the Lambs. Is it superior? I don't think so, but
no.
I do think it is a really, really good movie. I could, I guess, briefly give a synopsis. We have Morgan Freeman playing William Somerset, a detective that is getting ready to retire. He gets assigned a case of a murder he's going to investigate, and a new partner that has transferred there, David Mills, played by Brad Pitt. He's only got is it 7 days? It seems like seven comes up a lot in this movie.
Until he retires. Yeah.
And so he's just trying to go through the ropes. But this is a really grisly murder case where a man is fed to death until his stomach ruptures. And Morgan Freeman's character, Somerset, is not keen on this being his last case, because he doesn't think it's going to get resolved in the time it takes for him to retire, nor does he think it's a good first case for his new rambunctious partner, Mills, who transferred from somewhere in Podunkdom to the big city. David has a wife named Tracy. She befriends Somerset in a way by inviting him over to dinner with them, because I think she realizes that her husband's kind of annoying at times, and she's kind of trying to get them to work well together. I think it's a really good bonding scene with the three of them. And then the fourth character in this book, in this movie, is John Doe, played by Kevin Spacey. John Doe is the killer in the movie, and we come to discover that these murders that they're investigating are motifed with the seven deadly sins of the Bible. The first one I mentioned already was gluttony. And then, of course, if you go down the list, they have greed and sloth and on and on and on. This movie has a very bleak ending, which is why a lot of people, I think, have a problem with it. I don't at all, because, even though I like Happily Ever Afters, I also like my bleak movies, too. The Shining's a bleak movie.
Silence actually ends with the killer escaping, the other killer, escaping. So there's that too.
Right.
I don't think it's just that the ending of this movie is bleak. This movie is bleak from the very beginning.
Yeah.
It stays bleak. It remains bleak. It. I think it's a choice that both the writer and the director made. It's definitely in Somerset's character. He is extremely, I don't want to say pessimistic, but he is, there's a bleakness to him. He doesn't like, even down to the very last Somerset Maugham sort of, or Hemingway quote at the end.
Yeah.
Said in Morgan Freeman speak, which is always good, no matter what
the voice of God, according to Brad Pitt.
But yeah, and yeah, I can see not only why people would be turned off because it is bleak and the resolution is bleak and everything, but also it's a very visceral movie, mm-hmm. but not in a gore in your face, Saw, hostile sort of way. It's a mm-hmm. visceral movie in what it doesn't show as well as what it does show. And that makes it even worse. You know, we talked in Jaws about how not showing the shark is what made it actually scarier. Mm-hmm. And the same thing in this. We never see what happens to Lust and the hooker.
But we see the after effects.
What we imagine is yeah. not good, you know, and what we imagine, you know, we never see a full scene, really. Even any of these murder scenes, the closest we probably get is Pride with the model, because we get that big shot of just her on the bed and it written in blood above her and all of that. But that's the biggest really glimpse we see. You know, Gluttony, we see pieces, parts of him, and we see a lot of crime scene photos, but we don't see details, and that makes it worse because we start imagining a lot more detail. I also found it an interesting choice that they don't mention any victim's name. I couldn't recall watching it again, because this is like only like the third time I've ever seen this movie, was rewatching it for this. Uh-huh. And I noticed that they never, other than the lawyer, because he had a name, he was important, popular, Gould or whatever it was. But like Sloth, I don't think they give his name. I don't think they give the hooker's name. They don't give the model's name.
Well, so. and Sloth is the drug addict pedophile, right? Yeah. The one that's still alive, and you don't realize it until he moves.
Yes.
They never say whether or not he lived. They just kind of go on.
The doctor said he won't.
That's it, though. That's all we get. Yeah. We never hear about him again. I think what you're saying is there's a detachment in this movie. Like, we don't know their names.
And there's an uncomfortableness.
I felt that as well. We don't know the name of the city. We don't know the setting.
Correct. You're never given the setting. It's raining all the time. His lighting and palette choices are very bleak and stark and muted. And almost every scene, with the exception of like the scene you said, but even it too, the bonding scene between Tracy and David and Somerset has some levity to it a little bit, has some humor. But
he plays with the dogs.
Underlying it is a lot of tension and a lot of uncomfortableness.
Well, there's a secret.
But that was just before he finds out the secret, though. Mm-hmm. Because that dinner was before the breakfast.
Right.
But the breakfast scene, uncomfortable, tension, da da da. Even the scene where they're shaving to get ready for the finale, or the they're taking John Doe to the bodies. Uh-huh. And they're shaving, and he goes, you know, they have that levity of, if I shave off a nipple, is it workman's comp? You know, and he says, yeah, I'll pay for it myself. But underlying all that is tension and suspense and uncomfortable. And I think that's what Fincher wanted.
I do, too. I think that detachment sets you up. I mean, I had the feeling the first time I saw this movie, it's not going to end happy. I knew that before I saw the ending. And I think that's what he was trying to do with all this detachment and emptiness.
You know, Somerset even says that. He goes, you know, this is not going to end happy. Mm-hmm. It's not going to end good.
Mm-hmm. It's like he's setting up the audience as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how was it received? I didn't do any research on its reception. I know that it was made fairly modestly, but
it was number one for 4 weeks, and it was the seventh highest grossing movie of 1995.
Okay.
So it did well.
Not great, but did well. Mm-hmm. I definitely think it probably had a resurgence, because I saw it on VHS. I did not see this movie in the theater.
Oh, I did.
I saw this movie on VHS. Yeah.
Of course, you and I are different. I go to the horror movies. You go to the sci-fi movies.
True.
Yeah, I saw this one on
screen. And I had not really heard of Fincher before. This was like my
Well, he had already done Alien 3. And I had read about him a lot in Fangoria because I was reading about all the problems with Alien 3 and his disgruntledness about it. He essentially came out of retirement to do this movie, claiming that directing another movie, he would rather have colon cancer because that's how mad he was at what they did with him on Alien 3.
Yes.
Yeah. But he came out because he got sent the wrong copy of the script. I don't know if you knew this. The producers of this film, the studio, had a happier ending from the original script by Andrew Kevin Walker. Andrew Kevin Walker's ended the way the movie ends that we saw. And that's the script that Fincher saw, so he signed on. And Brad Pitt signed on, too. But then they said, oh, no, we're not doing that one. This is the ending. And then both of them balked and said, then we're not doing it.
Then we're not doing it. No.
So they had to make a compromise. And they ended up having the bleak ending. But then David shot a little coda at the end with Morgan Freeman, the Hemingway quote, and Mills being driven away. Destroyed.
Yeah, that felt like an ad when I watched it this time.
That was his compromise. He agreed to do that. That was it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is still pretty bleak.
It's very bleak. I didn't go into details, but really quickly to continue the synopsis. They realize that they can trace John Doe via library records. It's an FBI tactic that had recently come into fruition. They find his house or his apartment, and it's full of all kinds of crazy religious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they find a clue that leads them to not to prevent the next murder, but to the next murder's body, which I think was Lust.
Yes.
Which was basically him forcing somebody to wear a razored appendage while raping a woman and murdering her. So that guy's alive, but probably fucked up for the rest of his life.
Then, he has a new fetish.
Yeah, and as they go back to the station, all of a sudden someone shouts at them. They turn around, and it's John Doe standing there with blood all over him. He agrees that he will confess to the murders of Envy and Wrath if they will take him to a certain place where he can show them the bodies. And Somerset doesn't want to do it. Mills does. And the way they get him is he says he will confess, and that if they don't do it, he will plead insanity, which would get him off. So
that was one of the major plot points I don't buy in this movie. It's like a big damn deal. He can plead all he wants to. Who gives a shit? We're still going to charge him with everything,
right?
You know.
It's a little faux pas. Anyway, they go, and this is the only scene that is really sunny and bright outside, which I find terribly ironic. They get out into the middle of this desert-like field with a bunch of high-tension wires, they park. Mills is holding a gun on John Doe. They see a van approaching. Somerset goes to meet the van. It turns out it's a delivery of a box, and Somerset opens the box and says,
"What's in the box?"
Says Mills, step away from him, step away from the, put the gun down, step away from him. And then we come to realize that John Doe says that he was envious of Mills' life and his wife, so her head is in the box, and Mills becomes the tool to be the final murder, which is Wrath. And that means he will kill John Doe, which is sublimely poetic and creepy and bleak and just about any other of that type of adjective you could add. It makes you leave the movie like you've been gut punched, literally, because you don't want him to win, but he does anyway. You want Brad Pitt to put that gun down.
Again, a very key reference back to Silence of the Lambs, in that the plan that the murderer has in effect works at the end. He does get what he wants. In Silence, he gets away and he has an old friend for dinner, you know. But in this one, he gets himself killed the way he wants to be, you know, death by suicide by cop kind of thing.
Agreed. But there are moments of Silence that make you like Lecter. You don't like John Doe in this at all.
Well, see, the sick part of me does like John Doe. I love the scene. My favorite scene in this movie is in the police car between him and Mills and Morgan. All of that dialogue is just so good. And he goes, oh, really? You know, I guess I enjoyed it about as much as Detective Mills would enjoy being locked in a windowless room with me for 15 minutes. You know, and you're going, oh, man. And such good, just that's good writing, good performance, everything. That whole scene is my favorite. But I did not realize until this viewing that every day is a new murder. So the seven sins, except for the last two, are all each a day apart.
I didn't realize that still. I
thought that was interesting. It started on Monday with gluttony, and then, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then there's that pause while shows himself.
But they don't have a day on. Do they show a day?
Yeah. The heading comes up like a X-Files thing or whatever. It says Monday.
Okay. I guess I just wasn't paying attention.
How can you got to pay attention to these movies?
Because it's important. Letting the art flow over
you. Flow over you. Yes. Of course. Of course you are. I think from a production angle, I do want to thank. Not thank, but I want to recognize.
I'd like to thank
whoever the writer is, and I didn't get his name, but he was really, really good.
Are you talking about the screenplay?
Yes.
His name is Andrew Kevin Walker, and I think this screenplay should be taught in school. This is a really well-done screenplay.
Yes. And what is conveyed with his work with Fincher, so there are entire things that are unsaid that show some great cinema acting and cinema storytelling. You know, just in between looks between Morgan Freeman's character and Brad Pitt's, you know, or between the way the other character that's in it is Arlie Ermey as their captain, their precinct captain,
correct,
who's a really good character as well.
I recognized him. I didn't put him in my cast notes. I just put the four biggies. But he was in Full Metal Jacket. Wasn't he the sergeant in Full Metal Jacket?
Kind of his. He started out as just the trainer for that movie, and Stanley Kubrick cast him in the role because nobody else could do it as well as he could.
Yeah.
And then he turned that into a movie career and even a television career. He did a couple of, I think, a series of, you know, He-Man, Handle Your Guns sort of.
He's a very butch, like, action movie kind of guy.
Yeah.
He looks that way, yeah.
Yeah. But I wanted to recognize definitely the writer, but also the cinematographer, Darius Kanji, I think is his name. He's Indian, I believe, or Armenian, one of those. But he's just great lighting and cinematography in these scenes, and the way it's, you know, the color is used and everything. And then the editor, who was Richard Francis Booth. I looked him up because he was nominated for this movie for editing right after, simultaneously, I guess the year before, being nominated for Shawshank Redemption. He edited that movie as well.
I didn't realize Shawshank was just a year before.
And that's very interesting. I found out in researching this. Because, again... from a production angle, but before we jump into like other things that we loved, I do have to ask, is this a horror movie? Do you think this is genuinely a horror movie?
I think this is every bit as much of a horror movie as Silence of the Lambs is.
See, I disagree, and I think it's because of the late introduction of the killer. I didn't get the sense of terror or horror or dread or anything in this movie as much as Silence. Silence, to me, I immediately go, it's a horror movie. This one, I say, it's a mystery with some really graphic stuff in it, in my opinion. I do not know if I would classify this as a horror movie because I'm genuinely never scared in this movie. When they go to the crime scenes, I'm not afraid something's going to happen or something's going to jump out. Even when they have the huge chase in the middle chasing John Doe, I'm not scared. I mean, I'm hyped up because of the chase,
but.
The only time I get creeped out is when they go to his apartment. Then I started going, oh, okay, it's kind of creepy. And then the scene in the car is creepy. And then the ending is memorably.
The ending is scary. just awful. And the but you're leaving out a very key element of horror for me, and that is dread. And this movie is dreadful from the very beginning. We talk about slow burns. This is a slow burn. An anti-slow burn, almost. It's slow and creepy, but they don't hesitate to reveal these victims steadily, and the dread just increases with each victim to me as it proceeds. It also it's foreshadowed a lot when Morgan Freeman looks at him and says, "You are letting your emotions control you. You've got to stop this," when they're sitting at the bar.
Yeah.
And it's foreshadowing what's going to happen at the end.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of poetic justice in a lot of this. There's a lot of symbolism in this. His use of seven all the way through it is, you know, in there, obviously. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, yes, I agree with the bleak. I agree with the dread. I think Somerset's character is not depressing so much as he is fatalistic all the way through this. And I get that. But I was not scared any time I've ever seen Seven. Whereas in Silence, there are moments where I just go, or I creep out, or I'm just going, oh, no, 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 oh, no, don't walk, don't do, no, oh, you know.
Well, you also have a lot more history with Silence because you've read the books, you know the sequels, you know the prequels, too.
Yes, true, 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 true.
But again, I mean, I just think about it this way. What if you took someone unaccustomed to this type of movie, to it? Do you think they would think it's a horror movie? I think so.
Possibly. I think it's a, you know, again, one of the big keys, I'll just jump to it. One of the keys that I have from this is there was a sequence in CSI, the original CSI that was set in Vegas. There was a sequence, I think it started in like the fifth or sixth season and went for like 3 years, and it was the dollhouse killer. And what he would do is they would find this bizarre scene of a murder, and somewhere in that scene would be a little box, or they would get shipped a box at the forensics lab. And when they opened it, it was an exact miniature replica of the crime scene, except if they looked close enough and did the right testing and yada yada, there would be a clue there that would help them move the story forward. It's called the miniature murder, the dollhouse killer, whatever. But it was a lot like that.
It's a story arc is what it is.
Correct. And it went through, like I said, like 3 or 4 seasons of they never catching this killer who was so meticulous in his staging of the crimes. And that's what I felt like in this. This was a great procedural mystery, da da da. So, and the reason I bring this up and I'm kind of belaboring it is because I was thinking, okay, would I have felt more if maybe we had seen glimpses of his journals or other than in the credits, if we had seen, which are brilliant, by the way, the credits are great.
And so is the music choice of the Nine Inch Nails.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it said music by Howard Shore, and I could never find any reference to Nine Inch Nails. And I was going, that's definitely a Nin song. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. It's Trent Reznor, who has also worked with David Fincher since on several movies.
Many movies and series, too.
But Howard Shore did do the incidental music in the film itself.
And Howard Shore did
Silence of the Lambs. Yeah.
But so I kept thinking, maybe if I got more of a hint of John Doe, either his apartment or him or something, the journal, whatever, more at the beginning, maybe I would have a little bit more scare. But I don't know. I'm just saying. To me, it wasn't scary.
I don't know, man. I mean, he walks in. Well, of course, this is on a second viewing. But when he walks in and they're going up the stairs and he's yelling Mills or Detective Somerset, whatever it is he says. And they find, and then he yells at them. He literally yells, and they turn. He is covered in blood. And if you have seen this movie before, you know that that's Mills' wife's blood. that it's all over him.
Or it could be the models, because he went to her too, you know. Did her the same day. Both those are the same day.
Okay. But he had to get that head in a box into a delivery before he went there to meet them. So I'm assuming it's his wife.
Which goes into, you know, people who listen to Johnny Has the Keys know David will have some plot issues.
Well, I mean, I don't think that was your average delivery man. I think he just found somebody and gave him a lot of money.
Well, that's fine, too. But still, there's so much in this plotting that is totally, totally depends on certain things that there is no way you could have planned it that way.
Well, you know I love Silence of the Lambs, but there is no way that Hannibal Lecter could have got that body in the cell up like an angel spread open like that and still escape.
Agreed.
There is no way in hell. So, I mean,
totally agree. But every other... Okay, I will, but I'll say to you, that is a plot point of that particular character doing that one thing. The rest of that movie is fairly well plotted. This one has so many things where it's contingent not on the killer doing something. He is planning on somebody else doing something in order for it to go forward. Mm-hmm. The very first one being, okay, so he planned this a year in advance, because he started torturing dude in the bed a year ago today, is what they say when they find the picture.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Had to plan it probably for longer than that. Somerset said he has, 12,000 journals or whatever, however many damn he counted or that he has there. Anyway. The first one is...
John Doe to your house.
He has planned this in such a way that a detective will find linoleum pieces in his stomach of the victim and put that together with the refrigerator moving in order to move the refrigerator to see the very first element of the plot.
Honestly, when I saw that, I didn't think that was done intentionally. I thought that he probably just moved the refrigerator, saw those things there, and thought, oh, I'll just feed them to him.
Okay, well,
I didn't see it. I thought that it, being a crime scene, I think they would have already looked behind the refrigerator. I was kind of surprised that they hadn't.
Right.
You know?
The other one was... Obviously, them finding him threw off his plan, because he calls them and says, you know, after the unfortunate instance of today, I've had to rethink or whatever. However, I forgot that dialogue.
Right.
But he basically says, you know, it's interesting, you know, sorry, I had to hurt one of you sort of thing. That was interesting. But so he obviously changes his plan there. So his envy and wrath plan was not what happens. He had
maybe
a different
not.
Plan.
Now that means somebody lived to see another day.
But then that means that his entire plan was predicated on being able to, first of all, do all these murders and not get caught. One in huge security in an office building and everything else. The other one is he kills both Tracy and the model in the same day. He has to kill her, cut off her face, wrap her up, da, da, da. Then go to his house, cut off her head, get that head in a box, find a guy to pay him to bring it out at 7 o'clock tonight, guaranteeing that if it doesn't happen, nothing in my plot happens. If this is not delivered, I can't do my ending, right? Well, I don't get my grand scheme.
But it is delivered, David.
See, there you go with the...
It is delivered. And if it hadn't been delivered, we would have seen an alternate universe version, where he just basically taunts Mills into shooting him.
All right, I'll just shut up now, but I'm just saying that there's certain plot elements in this that don't work.
You're a little bit possessed by the spirit of our old friend Wendell.
No, it just doesn't work for me. But that's okay.
A little bit on production before we go to scenes.
Yeah.
I think I already told you that Fincher, Spacey, and Pitt not agreeing to do the film if they changed the ending. Uh-huh. But Fincher also told Kevin Spacey and Brad Pitt that this is not going to be a movie you'll be remembered for, but you're going to be extremely proud of it. And I thought that was an interesting motivation.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Several other people, before we get into casting, but several other people were supposed to direct this movie. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
Jeremiah Chechik is the only one that I don't know. He was attached, but and so was Al Pacino when he was going to do it. David Chechnik is known for the movies National Lampoon's Vacation and The Avengers, not the superhero version, but the British version with Uma Thurman.
Wow.
Yeah, so I don't know much about him, but he was attached to it. Our friend Guillermo del Toro was attached to this film as well. He turned it down. He said that he is pretty much a romantic and just could not get past the bleakness of the script, which I love because del Toro really is a romantic. I mean, you see it in The Shape of Water.
That's crap. He said this isn't really a horror movie; it's a procedural. That's what he said.
Well, none of his are horror, really. They're kind of fantasy.
Yeah, they are. He does.
However, we may be covering one of those horror fantasies later this season.
Okay.
And then also, and you'll love this, and he turned it down. I have no idea why, but David Cronenberg was offered this movie as well. And he is a horror movie director. You cannot deny that.
No, not at all.
So,
I'd be curious. I bet there would have been much more grotesque sort of crime scenes.
Right. Andrew Kevin Walker, as we mentioned, wrote the screenplay. He has written other good screenplays, including Sleepy Hollow, which I enjoyed. A lot of people didn't like the Tim Burton version of that. And a movie called 8mm, from what I understand, is a great script, but it has Nicolas Cage in it, so the movie's not that great. Seems like I heard that somewhere.
Yeah. I heard that too.
So he has written other things. He wrote this movie while living in New York. He hated living in New York and said had he not lived in New York, he probably would have not written this movie. But he was working at Tower Records at the time, which I thought was kind of fun.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that it was the seventh highest growing film that year. And it was also regarded as the first A-list picture for New Line Cinema, the house that Freddy Krueger built, horror movie company. It has 4 Oscar winners starring in it.
Mm-hmm.
All 4 of these guys have won Oscars. So that's what I have as far as background. I think I mentioned to you off screen that he used a process called bleach bypass, which made the film look dingy.
Desaturated.
Something about the silvers not being removed from the stock. It's a very unique looking film.
And you mentioned that right before we started recording, and I remember, I'm trying to remember, there were a couple of other movies I remember using that process, and I can't remember them right now, but they used it creates that really muted look that everything has, almost like a monochromatic look to things. Mm-hmm. Everything's kind of saturated, a desaturated kind of look. Yeah. You said 4 Oscar winners. I have to tag onto that because you can tell. These are, even Gwyneth Paltrow in her, she only has 3 scenes and one of those is in bed with Brad Pitt, but they're so good. Her expressions are so good. Her moments work. Of course, then again, she's acting opposite Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt.
Well, and her and Brad Pitt were in a relationship at the time, too. So they were very comfortable with each other.
Yeah, that you could tell. That just worked. Mm-hmm. All of the scenes with Somerset and Mills are great. They're good. They're nuanced. Nothing seems to be, they seem so natural together, but also they're giving a great deal of plot information. Mm-hmm. He's talking about library cards over here. They're talking about Dante and they're talking about
Catholicism. It's very minimal, but you get the gist of what's happening.
Yes, you get so much.
Love that kind of writing.
Yeah. It's so again, writing, direction, cinematography, editing, and the performances. It just has everything going for it. It's just that the subject matter might turn some people off.
It does. A lot of people, excuse me, a lot of people had problems with this movie because, I could never show this movie to my husband, Dennis, because he would just be like, F you for a week, because he wants his movies wrapped up in a little bow and to look real pretty and be happy. And he would just, this would devastate him.
You know, you've got, I know, you got me thinking, you know, there is no hope in this movie in any instance. Mm-hmm. Even down to there's, you know, the little scene between the sergeant and Somerset, and he goes, what are you going to do when you retire? You can't get out of this job. You know, this is what you do.
And Brad flips it on him, too.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you say you're retiring because the world's like this. I say you're retiring and using that as he flips the reasoning on him and gets Morgan to think. I mean, not Morgan, but Somerset. Because at the end of the movie, you kind of get the gist that he's not going to retire.
Well, he says in like right before the scene when they're getting out of the car and we're focused on the taxi, which, by the way, hey, a bloody guy just got in my taxi. I think I'll drive him to the police station. Sure, whatever. But anyway, when he's getting out, they're talking and he says, I'm going to stay on a few days as your partner. I'm not going to retire because I do want to see the end of this case. Mm-hmm. And he goes, you don't do me any favors, man, but, you know, whatever. But
that was the Nick Cage version.
Yeah, sorry. But there's even down to she's talking about they just got pregnant. But instead of it being a happy thing, there is no hope for her. She doesn't like the schools. She doesn't like the town. She wants to move back. And he even says, if you decide to keep it, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm like, there's no hope in this movie.
I mean, that whole scene. Actually, I could put that in as a key right now that I think about it. But that whole scene where he talks to her about whether or not to keep it reminds me of the scene where Ken Forhey talks to the woman in Dawn of the Dead about,
oh, yeah.
Do you want to keep it?
You want to keep it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And their scenario is the same. It's bleak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of anybody who survives or is even remotely attached to these crimes is hopeless. The doctor saying, you know, well, this guy has suffered the more than any other thing I've ever seen. You know, the poor guy who had to put on the razor thing is probably, like you said, is scarred for the rest of his life.
That's a key too. I just realized I will put that. I just remembered something else. Okay. You say it's not a horror movie. I say it is, but you have to agree that even though it's a crime story, it's a hybrid of some sort. It is definitely not just your basic crime story.
No,
this story is sick and evil and bleak. I can't use that word enough. Sorry, people, I will stop. But it is just depressing.
Yes.
A lot of those emotions are associated with horror.
And there is no hope in every scene. Even, like you said, the only real levity scene in this movie is the bonding scene over dinner. And he's uncomfortable because he's folding a napkin the whole time. And they're upset because a train keeps going by and they hate their apartment that they just rented.
That's fun. And that is levity. You know? But I would also give a little levity to the bar scene and a little levity to the shaving scene where he's talking about Workman's Comp and stuff. That's
correct.
Like
I said, there's hopelessness underneath all those. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And they never mention the city. They keep talking about how bad it is living here. I mean, even that one story, it's just like three lines, but where Somerset is talking to the captain and says, you know, two blocks from here, a guy was mugged, and then the guy stabbed him in the eyes.
And he said, yeah, I read about it this morning or something in the paper. So they were talking about something one of them had just read. Yeah.
Right. And it's just bleak.
Well, I mean, I've got another key. I'm giving away my keys here. But, I mean, it reminds me of The Dark Knight because it's like Gotham City. It is just a dirty, grimy, crime-ridden city.
Yeah.
So there's references to other movies that are not even horror in it too.
Yeah. Dark Knight's a good one I had not thought of because, again, a very police sort of procedural about this killer who's on the loose, but with a bleak undertone, a very dark underbelly.
Very dark. Yeah. Before we move along to cast, and I have a lot of information on casting, what scenes stick out to you? Let's toss a few of those out there real quick.
Well,
you know what I'm going to say.
Gluttony always sticks out to me because it is the first one.
That one.
And it is shown so atmospherically. Mm-hmm. That one sticks out to me. The two humanistic scenes, meaning the dinner scene, I like a lot. The breakfast scene, I like a lot. The two of them, their dialogue, their intimacy, that's a really nice scene between Freeman and Paltrow. The jump scare, the jump scare scene, because whatever the hell. And again, we get such weird glimpses of this body on this bed that we don't know what the hell has happened to him. We just know it was not good. It was... he basically flailed the guy, he starved him,
he kept him on drugs, he's emaciated. You're talking about Sloth, right?
Yeah, and the fact that Sloth suddenly fucking sits up.
Sit up, he gasps, and the breath is what scares you. That's my scene right there.
Jump scare.
That sent me over the edge because I had no idea that guy was still alive because he looks like a fucking corpse.
Yeah, of course not. And then the apartment, of course, his apartment, and then the final scene. Of course, you always remember the final scene.
The final scene is like the one you see at the Oscars.
What's in the box?
It's on the Oscar trailer reel.
Of course. What about you?
I was going to mention the Sloth scene too, because it did scare me, and it's the closest thing to a zombie in this movie, so you know I'm going to like it. I will say that the actor, I don't have his name, they cast an actor that only weighed 95 pounds, and David Fincher jokingly said, "Hey, lose some more weight," and he lost 6 more pounds.
Oh my God.
I know. He thought the guy took him seriously.
Of course.
So the guy already looked emaciated. And then, of course, Rob Bottin did the effects for this movie. I think, did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Unless, maybe I didn't put it in my notes.
That's good, though. Yeah.
The effects are amazing. That may be something I should check before we get off of here. But I'm pretty sure Rob Bottin did the effects. I may actually have it in my notes somewhere. I just haven't got to it yet. That scene sticks out to me. The scene you said with them at the apartment with Tracy is a great scene. But I like it especially after I think Tracy goes to bed and they start doing a little bit of research. And he's like, "I'm going to get another beer. You want one?" And he says, "No, wine." And then they just start getting down and doing the work. And I love that. I love the scene where Morgan Freeman goes to the library. I just think it's a great scene where he knows all the security guards there. They're used to him coming there after closing hours and doing his research. And he's looking up all the ancient biblical crap that represents what this guy is, trying to accomplish. I didn't mention this. I could do this really quick. But the 7 deadly sins are lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, envy, and pride. I always tend to mix them up. Sometimes I want to say anger instead of wrath. The scene you said with gluttony definitely sticks out to me, and of course the ending. The ending alone, I don't know what it is. It's the juxtaposition of the dread with that bright sunshine that just resonates with me. Because it's like all of a sudden the movie's not dark and rainy, but what's going to go down is darker and rainier than anything you've probably already seen. So.
Well, and it's a hybrid of that we talked about, or I've started talking about in the podcast of, is the audience with you, behind you, or ahead of you,
Oh, yeah.
the characters. And this is kind of a hybrid of that because we're with Somerset's character, but we're ahead of Mills because we know and he doesn't, and we know what's going to happen. And we're
it's
like,
Brian De Palma, man. Where's the split screen?
Right. And yeah. But we're behind. But we're behind John Doe because he planned the whole thing. Right. And he knows this is going to happen. And it was really interesting. I loved that whole final scene. You just said something really cool. It'd be interesting to see how a Brian De Palma would have approached this, because he would have done the split screen. I guarantee it right there. That would have been simultaneous with him opening it up and him talking and goading him, so that it kind of like both explodes at the same time kind of thing. It would have been interesting. Yeah.
And Brian hasn't done a lot of gore, but when he does do gore, it's very effective gore.
Oh,
like,
yes.
There's a brutal stabbing in the movie Sisters. And, of course, there's a lot of blood in Carrie. So I don't know how he would have handled this movie.
The driller killer thing in
Body Double?
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
So, yeah.
Doesn't it go through like a floor and
it goes through the floor and drips on the guy downstairs?
Yeah. Like, I forgot.
So casting, you have a bunch, you said.
I do, but just because of the four leads. Before Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt were cast and there was a different director, the original choices were Al Pacino and Denzel Washington. Al Pacino for the Somerset part and Denzel Washington for the Mills part.
I mean, I could see that. I'm not... I mean,
Al Pacino's great, but I just have a special place in my heart for Morgan Freeman.
Everybody does.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know if Pacino could have played the fatalism as subtly and as convincingly as Morgan Freeman.
Uh-huh.
You know, like he's an old retired guy who's just ready.
Well, I mentioned to you that some director named Jeremiah Chechik was attached to direct it with Al Pacino. Well, Jeremiah jumped ship and went to direct City Hall, and Al Pacino jumped ship with him and was in City Hall. So that's what happened there.
Okay.
There you go. Washington turned it down, deeming it too dark. So it's not just the audiences that think this movie's too dark. Some actors did, too.
And Guillermo del Toro.
However, both he and Al Pacino have come out and said they regretted the decision. So,
of course.
Yeah. Gene Hackman was offered the role of Somerset, but he turned it down because of too many night shoots. I guess he doesn't like shooting movies at nighttime.
Yeah, he has to have his beauty sleep.
Right.
Yes.
Robert Duvall also turned down the role.
Hmm.
Harrison Ford was considered for the role of Somerset. And Andrew Kevin Walker, when he was writing the screenplay, said he envisioned William Hurt as Somerset.
Oh, yeah. Either one of them could have done that part very well. Yes.
Him or Harrison Ford?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Hurt or Ford could have, I think both could have done Somerset with, you know, but Freeman's just got that voice too. Neither one of them have that.
Brad Pitt calls it the voice of God.
Yeah.
I think that's hilarious. I'm going to move on to Brad Pitt's character, but I will say before I get into it that one of the reasons Brad took this role is because he had just been painted as the poster child of A River Runs Through It. And he was trying to shake that image because he wanted to be no more for acting than a pretty face. So he went straight into this film and straight into 12 Monkeys, where I think he's great in both of them.
Mm-hmm.
This one, he literally did break his hand when they were filming. They said that he showed it to David Fincher and you could see his bone where he had busted his hand open and that Fincher had to like run for a toilet.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of the time when you see him in a cast, it's because he's really hurt. So Denzel Washington turned down that part because it was too dark and regretted it. Guess who else turned it down? And you are going to be like, what? Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, God, no. Oh, God. No.
Sylvester Stallone thinks he made a mistake.
No, he didn't.
I don't think he made a mistake at all, because the movie would have not been the same had it been him.
No. Would not have been. No.
Two other people. You're going to love this. Nicolas Cage. We've already made fun of him once. And I mean, he would have been about the right age probably, but no.
Yeah.
No. And Kevin Costner turned it down. So, I mean, they would have been playing with age, because some of these guys are younger or older. Like, I mean, if you put, who did I say?
Pacino.
Like, if you put Harrison Ford in the Somerset role and Kevin Costner in the Mills, they'd be about the same age almost, wouldn't they?
Yeah, close. You wouldn't do that.
It'd be weird.
I think almost all of those are more in line with Somerset than Mills.
I do too, and it made me wonder, but it specifically said David Mills where I copped this out of IMDb, so I'm assuming it's correct.
Yeah, I wouldn't have done that. You would have had to have, you know, an octogenarian play Somerset. Then,
I don't have a lot about Tracy. However, apparently it was offered to Christina Applegate, and she turned it down. Big mistake. I think it would have got Christina a little more notice earlier, because she was just coming out of Married with Children.
Married with Children, yeah.
However, David Fincher was extremely impressed with Gwyneth Paltrow's work in a movie called Flesh and Bone. I'm not really sure what that is.
I haven't seen that.
I haven't either.
Nope.
And he says she was his first choice. So maybe Christina was considered when that other director was in it. I don't know.
Could have been.
But Paltrow was initially not interested, but Fincher asked her then boyfriend to coax her into meeting him. And that's how all that went down. I thought that was kind of funny. Now we're going to get on to John Doe. I mean, Kevin Spacey is wonderful in this role. I know that he has a lot of baggage with him right now as far as being a human being. But he is a great actor. He has done some great films, including this one. And he is spectacular in this role.
I mean, I think everyone's going to have to, hopefully, when the pendulum shifts, however it shifts, realize that, you know, you can appreciate the work and not appreciate the artist kind of thing. And even if that is a performer or an actor or something like that, I mean, Kevin Spacey has always been one of my favorite actors. I think he's done incredible work. And his personal side aside, this is a great performance. For the amount of screen time that he has, it is a powerful character and very well done.
I agree.
And he went on to work with Fincher. I mean, he created the role in, you know, House of Cards, and Fincher created that and produced that. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge Spacey thing before the fallout.
And I think he was already known. I can't remember if it was Garden of Good Evil or original or Unusual Suspects, but
Usual Suspects came out like a week before this or something.
Okay, because he wanted to be billed in order of appearance or something. He didn't want people to know he was in the movie because they would guess early on who the killer was or something. I can't remember. They did something to try to disguise that. Kevin Spacey was not the first person considered for this. Apparently, Val Kilmer turned it down.
Okay.
I mean, Val can be wonderful. He's got a reputation too, though, now that's a little cuckoo.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, of course, I think he's got throat cancer or something. I saw something the other day where he was speaking with a talk box. Another person considered for this movie who I think would look the part but is obviously not an actor is Michael Stipe of REM was considered for this.
Really?
Yes. I'm like, I've never seen him in a movie, but he would not be as strong as Kevin Spacey. I kind of think I could put a bet on that. So, And another one that is a little unusual that I would have kind of liked to seen in an alternate universe is Ned Beatty was considered. And I had not seen him. I mean, what's he done? I mean, he's dead now, but I mean, he was known for Deliverance.
Interesting.
I think that his that would have been kind of an interesting choice for like
kind of inspired me because yeah, I remember him as the humorous character in the bad Superman when Lex Luthor is Gene Hackman.
Oh yeah, he was.
And Gene Hackman would have been an interesting choice for John Doe. It would have been interesting to see him. Because he can play mean when he wants to. He can play that creepy evil. That would be neat to see Hackman in that role as opposed to the Somerset role. But yeah, I would not have considered Ned Beatty at all for that. But that's interesting.
Me either. That's why I said it would have been like a comeback for him had it worked.
Yeah.
I think. But anyway, that's all I have. But I mean, I knew I had a pretty good bit for four different actors. I mean, that's a generous bit of casting there. I can move on to awards real quick.
Sure.
You mentioned that it was nominated for editing as far as an Academy Award. It was.
Yep.
It was nominated for screenplay across the pond with the BAFTAs. And as far as our friends over at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, the Saturn Awards, it won Best Writing and Best Makeup. And it was Rob Bottin. That's where I saw his name. Bottin did the makeup. And it was nominated for Best Film, Best Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. Morgan Freeman and Gwyneth Paltrow.
I could see that. Yeah.
It was also nominated for Best Director and Best Music, Howard Shore. And lastly, it is on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die.
As it should be. I mean, it definitely should be. This is an impressionable movie, whether you want to classify it horror, mystery, police procedural, whatever.
It's all of the above.
Yeah, it is still one that should be on the 1001. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Unlike some of the other ones that we have seen and done that need to punt off.
Are you talking about Fantastic Planet? You are, aren't you?
Maybe. Could be. Mm-hmm. I've just got a few notes before keys. I've got, of course, what we've talked about, great editing, great performances, blah, blah, blah. Great credit sequence. I mentioned it earlier, but it does set the tone for this entire movie. And it's after the teaser. So there's a teaser, and then there's the credit sequence. And it's very visceral. It's the music is great with Nine Inch Nails, and it just sets that whole tone for the movie, I think. I've got a different Davidism. When he goes back to look at to find the slivers of the refrigerator, he cuts through the keep out sign, keep out police thing. It's taped on the inside of the door. Why would it be taped on the inside of the door?
Oh, I didn't even notice. You're talking about Morgan Freeman, right?
Yeah. Made no sense to me, but there you go. I've got in my notes, terrified because what the hell happened to the prostitute? We don't even get to see that, but maybe we don't want to.
No, I think they opted for the performance of the victim that was forced to kill her. And it's a great performance, and I recognize that actor, but I did not put him in my notes.
And again, tell, don't show. We imagine a lot worse, just that occasional glimpse. He throws that picture down, and we don't even get a good look at it. Mm-hmm. Whatever this device was that the leather guy made was not...
Like a razor strap-on dildo is what I picture. Yeah. A razor.
And then my last watch note is I love the fact that Fincher puts us in the helicopter view a lot during that last scene. So we're very voyeuristic. We're watching, looking down on these, even through binoculars sometimes.
I would go as far as to say omnipotent. It's like God looking down at this play coming to
and they end. Have no mm-hmm. way of affecting it.
Yeah.
They're just observers. They can't do anything to change the fate of what's happening.
And that's just so very that Greek. Was... God, you know what? That's another thing I could put in as a key. It's like a Greek drama. You know it's a tragedy, and it's going to be a tragedy. There's no way it's ever going to end.
Yeah, and you go happy. Into this knowing it's a tragedy. Yeah. It will be bad. This will yeah. not...
I mean, it reminds me of Oedipus in a way. Yeah.
Yeah, without the big reveal at the end.
Well, but the Oedipus, the chorus of Oedipus is what brings all the dread and the prophecy
yes,
and stuff.
The dread, too. Yeah. And yeah. he does that with music and cinematography in this, right. that dread all the way through it. Yes, mm-hmm. I agree with that. That's good.
I have a little bit of trivia before we get into keys. Okay. Well, actually, there's one other thing I wanted to say. You were talking about the credits and the Nine Inch Nails. The ending credits are good to me. I love them personally because Bowie was working with Trent Reznor at the time, and he did an album that tanked called Outside. But there's one great song on it called The Heart's Filthy Lesson. And that is the song you hear in the end credits. It's
Bowie. Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think Fincher may have done the video for him. I can't remember. But that album Probably. Tanked, so it didn't do well at all. But I like it because it's kind of industrial sounding.
Mm-hmm.
Fincher went on to do Fight Club in 1999, mm-hmm. and he named his fighters Andrew, Kevin, and Walker for the guy that wrote this screenplay. I thought that was kind of cute.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good.
And it's and then as an afterthought, it says, needless to say, Walker did uncredited rewrites for Fight Club.
I'm sure.
Did you have anything else as far as
nothing trivia-wise or anything like that? Great screenplay, great director, great movie overall.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a few keys.
Yeah, let's hear them.
Before I jump to keys. Okay. And I think I mentioned this on a podcast when I had seen it months and months ago, but Fincher's latest work is Mank.
You have mentioned that.
Which, again, is probably, trying to think, I think it's probably Fincher's best movie. This is really good and a really great movie. And Fincher did a good modern adaptation of... The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I think he directed the U.S. version of that. I much okay. prefer the Swedish version, but the U.S. is good. Again, a dark kind of look like this. But Mank is brilliant. It is such a really good movie. And I'm really hoping that he might be nominated or was nominated or whatever for it. Anyway,
you just opinion. Reminded me of something I was reading earlier before we started about this movie's bleak ending. Someone said that this movie has the bleakest ending since the foreign version of The Vanishing.
Mm. Oh, my gosh.
And that was also, wasn't that a Swedish film? I think
yep.
that was from the Netherlands as well. And you just
and it's really good.
Yeah, you it's, just mentioned that.
The original. I didn't really like the Kiefer Sutherland, the remake, the U.S. version.
I haven't seen either.
Yeah. See the original. The original's good.
Okay.
But
what? A foreign film?
There are a couple that are out there that are good. And they're both in your genre, ironically.
Is Girl with the Dragon Tattoo a horror movie or a crime movie?
Good point. It's a crime movie. It's not a horror movie. Although it's got some really scary scenes. But it's a suspense crime. Okay, my first key, just like yours, going back to Greek chorus, my first key is film noir. This has a lot of that noir feel, that detectives from the 40s that really washed out tone, the way they're, especially the way Mills' dialogue is so pedantic and, you know, domestic and cussing all the time. It's very, has that kind of hard-boiled detective kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
That's my first one. My second one is Lethal Weapon. This is Lethal Weapon if it was bleak.
Oh my God, you're right. Because he is a little crazy because he's so rambunctious.
Yeah. Like and then you've got the old guy who's getting ready to retire, who finally takes on one last partner kind of thing. And they have this huge case that bonds them together kind of thing. So it was very lethal. I got a lot of Lethal Weapon vibes when I watched it this time.
Yeah, and I hadn't really thought about that.
And if we want to go comic, Odd Couple.
Well, and wasn't Danny Glover retiring or something?
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, his character was retiring. That's the whole point.
Oh, my God. There's a lot of similarities there.
Yeah. So it's Lethal Weapon with a bleak, huge undertone.
Yeah, it's
to
like
it.
The anti-Lethal Weapon.
Yeah. Odd Couple or any of those police procedurals that developed from this, I think. There was a lot that were the buddy cop kind of movies that everybody, they even spilled into television.
And Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Yeah, Falcon and the Winter Soldier. There you go. There was one before this, I think, as far as I'm thinking, back in the 70s.
48 Hours was one that would probably fit.
Yeah. Yeah,
because that was a buddy cop one that was kind of dark with Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy.
Well, then, the 70s and 80s had a lot of the singular detectives, the Columbos, the Banachek's, the
Kojak.
Kojak, all of those. It wasn't until, and I'm not sure if it was around the same time or whatever, but definitely after this, a lot more the buddies on television and in movies. And one of them's the... Oh, we've got to obey the rules. And the other one's, no, we break the rules every now and then and it works because, we're cops and we do, or whatever. One's the gruff one and one's the nice one, however they tried to do it, Oh, wait, so I'm doing all mine. What are yours? You got keys?
We can't miss the elephant in the room. We already mentioned that Silence of the Lambs to me. There's a huge homage. And this movie came out just... Silence won the Oscar in 91, and this came out in 95. So it's just 4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But I would go even further back to the one that Michael Mann did called Manhunter, which was a little bleaker and a little grayer than Silence. Does that make sense? I think Silence is a much better movie, but the Manhunter seemed grittier to me, which this movie seems grittier.
It was Michael Mann, and much, much grittier. I agree with that. You said Manhunter. I've got in my notes Mindhunter, the Netflix series that came out a few years ago.
Yeah.
Again, you've got the older guys established, the young kid that comes in, and then partnering together, they're trying to solve these horrible, crimes. Yes. And I think Fincher produced that.
I think that's Fincher's baby, and they're waiting on him to do a third season.
And they're waiting on him to do the next season.
Wow, that makes perfect sense. Now that I had completely forgotten that was his series.
I'm pretty sure that's a Fincher film.
Yeah, I think it is. I think he may direct them too.
Right.
Yeah. He's definitely a producer, though.
I've got Torture Porn, I think, came from this. I mean, especially Saw. This brilliant criminal who is putting people in horribly, horribly body horror situations.
Or almost artistically.
Yes.
Artistic choreographed murder, which is also variant Silence of the Lambs.
I was just about to say, that's an element that goes with Silence and even Hannibal and beyond, the other novels. Is that the serial killer as artist or as torture
as
genius.
Artist? That sounds like a novel, a book. The serial killer as artist.
As artist.
Written.
I've got a little bit of Agatha Christie. This is a mystery we are wanting to solve. We're wanting to know the little bits and pieces of it. Except instead of a drawing room, we're in a room with a guy in marinara sauce with a bucket of vomit, or whatever. But, it's that kind of thing. I got, again, one of my favorite scenes was his room, which has a huge neon cross over his bed and everything. But I got a lot of exorcist-y kind of vibes there. I think it was because of the Catholicism and trying to go into the church. But a lot of symbolism, mythology, Somerset paging through those journals, and we're just getting a sentence every now and then of some kind of horrible cruelty or guilt or pain.
Yeah, and you know. Friedkin movies of the 70s were gritty to me, too.
Because, yes.
I mean, French Connection's a gritty movie. Exorcist is a pretty gritty movie.
Yes.
It's that, we've talked about it before, that whole school of great 70s cinema just has that look. And this movie mm-hmm. could easily be the stepson of that look.
Okay, that's a great point. That's an excellent point because... Yeah. Yeah, the 70s had that, you know, the directors wanted realism and wanted realistic scenes and realistic locations and all of that. And everything has that gritty point of view to it, whereas the 80s became this very glossy, almost studio-produced sort of look to everything. This might be a return to that in the 90s with Fincher. Yeah, he's trying to get back mm-hmm. to that 70s vibe. That's a great point. That's really mm-hmm. good. And then my last reel, well, I've got one, which is, there was one I don't know that you can help me with, but before that, Usual Suspects, just because of Kevin Spacey, because it literally came out a month before this movie, and his performance as Virgil Kent, even down to the limp, I don't know why he limped as John Doe, because as soon as I saw him in silhouette limping, I was going, oh, it's Virgil Kent from... It's Kaiser Soze. Look.
I thought he was limping because of the chase scene with Brad earlier where he didn't kill Brad. Or
could have been.
Mills. Yeah.
Yeah, could have been. But we never really see him mobile until, you know, he's being chased. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, Usual Suspects for me. And then my last one, which you have to help me with, is there was a movie where a guy had a razor dildo.
Oh, that's I've got it. That's my key. That's my key. Hands off my key.
Okay, go for it. I don't know. I don't remember the movie.
Crimes of Passion. It's a Ken Russell movie.
Ken Russell.
With Kathleen Turner and Anthony Perkins.
Anthony Perkins. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And he is a whacked out priest, or he's dressed as a priest.
Priest, a preacher. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's killing prostitutes, and he has... there's this one hilarious scene where he's unpacking all these sex toys because I remember him holding up one and going, auto suck. And then he holds up a dildo. And when you flick this switch on a dildo, razors come out of it. And you're like, ooh, fuck, that's some serious business. So, yeah, I have that as a key because because of the murder scene with Lust and the razored object, whatever happens.
Right.
It reminded me of Crimes of Passion, which came out earlier in the 80s.
Well, there you go then. Yeah.
Ken Russell, who we have covered before in Altered States.
Altered States.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, so that was my last one. I mean, what else do you have?
Well, you mentioned CSI programs and procedurals. I would go ahead and throw X-Files in there as well because of the autopsy scene of Gluttony when the guy is like saying, mm-hmm. yeah, this stomach ruptured or whatever, and he's like holding up these oversized body organs.
Yes.
Gross.
Yeah, it's like, huge.
It's a guy, and it's not Scully, but it's close. I mentioned Dawn of the Dead just because I never really thought about it until you mentioned it, but because of the conversation between Ken Voorhees's character and Franny, Peter and Franny, that mm-hmm. is, over the potential abortion of her unborn child because they're in such a dire situation at the mall filled with zombies. I have Batman down, but what I meant specifically was The Dark Knight. We mentioned that.
Yep.
Because this is an unnamed city, but it's very much like Gotham. It is very dark and crime-ridden and gloomy and rainy.
Oh, yeah.
And then you mentioned... we mentioned film noir, Lethal Weapon, buddy cop movies, Manhunter, maybe that may be it. That may be it for me. I think Crimes of Passion was going to be my big reveal.
Yeah, and I didn't know it, but I remembered it. But there was, you reminded me of something that I think is clever, too, in the screenplay again and in the performance of, you know, we see that autopsy scene and we're, you know, and Mills is a little disgusted with this person, this poor victim, but he's mostly disgusted with him. And it's ironic that, or good writing, that then in that last scene, building up to that last scene in the police car, there, Spacey taunts him with that, with the, what, these weren't victims, what, this poor, this guy that you would have made fun of with your friends on the street if you'd saw him, you would have avoided him, you, I mean, he gives this horrible description, and you're going, yeah, I kind of had that thought when I was... When I was seeing the autopsy or when I was seeing the victim, I was like, yeah, probably true.
Right. I read that it took 14 hours to do that makeup.
For
Gluttony?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty nasty. Pretty nasty.
Yeah. Yeah, back to, I just thought of something else key-wise that is a tag on to you, but you mentioned Agatha Christie, and I was trying to think, what Agatha Christie? And I think the closest thing it comes to resemble is Ten Little Indians, mm-hmm. Which is also, and then There Were None, because you're anticipating the next murder.
Because we're given a precept to begin with. We're given a recipe.
I mean, we know these 10 people are going to die. In this movie, we know 7 people are going to die.
Yes.
And we're just waiting for the next one. So that's very much an Agatha Christie key.
Yep. Yeah. And it's that, again, we're ahead of the characters because we know the recipe. You know, we've been given that to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So that
the
kind
recipe.
Of... Yeah. You know. Or the precepts, whatever the concept is, you know, that it's there. You were talking about, you also reminded me, there's a lot of this, you don't see it in the pictures you have up right now because you got the last scene, which is sunlit. But in a lot of other images from this movie, they're very similar, without the green tones, they're very similar to the way the Wachowskis did Matrix. Matrix has that real desaturated look as well.
Oh, like that.
Yeah. They have that kind of look. Even that one, you know, the one of Gluttony there is very, even has the green tone. So it looks like Matrix.
Mm-hmm. They are very green toned. I know exactly what you mean. I did not pick up on what you were saying, but I do now. As far as the Matrix was, you think of the color green when you see that movie.
Right. Well, and yeah. You also, the blacks are very black. Everything is a very flat palette to it all the way through. Even when they're aboard the, you know, the ship, the Nebuchadnezzar, it's done in those metallic-y, rusty colors, but they're mm-hmm. They're all very bleak, I mean, very bland kind of looking. Which is the way this is. It's a very washed out kind of feel.
Yeah, it is. The only colored scenes other than the sun at the end is the scene where they're in the apartment. That's very warm too. Everything else is cold.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Even when they're outside in the daylight in a couple of those earlier scenes, like with Gluttony and everything.
It's white.
It's raining and it's white and
gray.
It's overcast and it's
mm-hmm.
ugly. Yeah.
So. Yeah. Well,
so, yeah,
I guess that
a week of bleak.
It is. Yeah. So welcome to the midway through our season. The depressing midpoint of our season was David Fincher's 7. Mm-hmm. We would like to thank you folks for joining us today. Mm-hmm. If you're, as David said, if you're new, we welcome you. If you're not, well, welcome back to our little bit of a depressing, dark, non-genre specific horror.
There you go.
I would like to say, if you are watching us on YouTube, please mm-hmm. subscribe. It's a little bitty effort on your part. It means mountains to us.
Oh, yes.
You can subscribe and ring that bell. If you are listening to us on a podcast, we would love for you to rate us or give us a review. Mm-hmm. If you follow us on YouTube, we do have a Johnny Has the Keys page on YouTube. Please suggest movies. We are always open for films. We don't just do fantastic movies. Sometimes we pick ones like last week.
Yes.
And sometimes we like to do bad movies just because they're fun.
Yes.
So anyway, and then if you, as David mentioned earlier, you can find us on Patreon as well, where we have plenty of free material, as well as a couple of subscription shows on Star Trek and the X-Files. David, I have totally enjoyed this, my friend, as I do every week.
Yes.
And we will see you next week in your world, a somewhat familiar world. I believe it's the same year, even.
Hmm. What could
might
it
even
be?
Have a same cast member.
What?
Can't yeah, wait. There's your hint, folks. You got seven days to watch it.
7 days, ironically. See you soon.
Bye.